All right, and with that, joining us right now is Dr. Paul Chung, who is an assistant professor and director of reconstructive urology at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, right here at home. Dr. Chung, we greatly appreciate a couple minutes of your time today. Of course, when we're talking about ED, it's a touchy subject, and some people are a little fearful to find out and to learn more, but we're greatly appreciative to get your expertise on this topic today.
Excellent. Thanks, Sean, for having me. And you're exactly correct. Any type of men's health issue, whether it be erectile dysfunction, urinary incontinence, prostate cancer, we as men, we just don't talk about this stuff enough. And I think the more we talk about it, the more we share it with our friends and family, the more people we're going to be able to help. And I think the people who are suffering from these issues are going to notice that there's a lot of people around them who can also give them the support and have gone through the same thing.
Excellent. All right. And once again, this is all brought to us by the fine folks, our friends over at Boston Scientific. So we greatly appreciate them teaming us up here with Dr. Chung. All right, Dr. Chung, let's start off with just a general question. What are the causes of ED?
Sure. Many of the patients I see in clinic, this is one of the first questions that they ask. And erectile dysfunction can actually be caused by many things. It can be a vascular issue. Perhaps related to prior strokes or heart attacks or high blood pressure or even diabetes. And for some people, it's even affected by the medicine that they might take. There are some blood pressure medications or even some antidepressant medications which can also affect erectile dysfunction. One of the other most common causes of erectile dysfunction is people who have undergone some type of treatment. The most common treatments may be prostate cancer or even erectile cancer treatment. These patients might have undergone some type of surgery or even radiation therapy, which makes their erectile dysfunction more prominent. But, you know, Sean, before we move on a little bit more, I wanted to just clarify you that erectile dysfunction means something different for each individual person. This can mean that somebody has a good erection, but maybe it doesn't last as long as they want. Sometimes it means that it can be not as strong to be able to penetrate. And for some people, it's an intermittent problem. Sometimes it works well, and sometimes it doesn't. And we have solutions for all these type of patients.
And for the people out there, please get over to edcure.org. Of course, you're going to hear a lot of answers from Dr. Chung, but if you're trying to learn more information, edcure.org is a great website with treatments and understanding ED as far as symptoms and causes. And like I said, we're going to get a lot of it from Dr. Chung here, but please do yourself a favor, get over there. And plus, you can find a specialist by just entering the zip code, whether you're listening here in Philly or surrounding areas around the country. And also, if you want, you can text ED Care to 73771, and they'll send you back a few short videos about treatment options and insurance information. Once again, joined by Dr. Chung here. And picking right back up, Dr. Chung, I would like to know, for the people that have low testosterone, does that cause ED in your opinion?
That's a good question, and low testosterone can be one part of a contributing factor that leads to erectile dysfunction, but rarely is it kind of the only factor. So for when a patient is undergoing an evaluation for erectile dysfunction, it is a lab that should be checked. However, we do take a more broad approach and not just focus on testosterone for these patients.
As far as treatment options go, and as I'm on that website, edcure.org, it seems like there are quite a bit of options to go over here. But if you could, please walk us down as far as, in your opinion, what are some of the treatments for ED?
Sure. You are correct. There are several types of ways that people might go about improving their erections. One of the most common ways is with an oral medication, such as Viagra or Cialis or Levitra. All of these medications generally work in the same fashion, so somebody might not need to try all of them to see if they work, but that is a good way to get started. One of the issues is that some people may have side effects from these medicines, and these medications may not work to the extent that somebody might want them to. There are other options that exist. They include using a vacuum erection device, also performing injections directly to help deliver a stronger dose of medicine right where it needs to go. That is actually a great way to get erections. However, some people might be afraid of using a needle or have a body habitus where using a needle may be a little bit more challenging. However, I want people to feel confident that it is a good way to be treated, and the providers will do a good job of instructing them on how and best to use it and how to safely use it. And one of the other great ways to treat ED is with a penile implant. And that's a procedure that can be done where an implant is placed on the inside, and that allows someone to be able to obtain a spontaneous sexual activity that lasts as long as desired.
All right, we're definitely going to talk a little bit more about the implant, but one of the things that I continue to hear be brought up is a shockwave therapy. Shockwave therapy. What can you tell us about shockwave therapy?
Sure. I'd also include another type of treatment with that, but two of the types of treatments that you may see on TV, also online, they include shockwave and also something called PRP, which is a platelet-rich plasma. These are types of new treatments which are coming out to help treat ED. One of the challenges with this type of treatment is that, first, it's not FDA approved at this time. So since it's not FDA approved, that means that the data or the research studies don't exist to really support its use at this time. I do think that these type of treatments should be studied, but under a type of research protocol. If someone's undergoing a research protocol, then generally the participant is not actually paying for it. That's kind of my opinion of shockwave and PRP at this time.
Okay, well, that all makes sense. All right, Dr. Chung, why should people see a urologist to treat their ED? Why do you think that's important?
So seeing a urologist is really important because, first, we're not going to just focus on the ED. We're going to focus on so many things, whether it be prostate cancer screening, how someone is urinating. But in regards to ED, we really understand why it happens. We understand all of the other medical factors, social factors, psychological factors that can affect ED. And we have the time to be able to talk with our patients about all of those. You can imagine that if you're going to your primary care physician to get treatment for ED, it's great. You know, they know what medication to start you on, but they're also seeing you for your blood pressure. You're also seeing them for your cholesterol issues. And it's really hard to have that in-depth discussion and to talk about these in a real personal level. So I think seeing a urologist is a great way to do that. The other thing is that a urologist is going to be able to take you across the whole journey. Remember, we just talked about all different types of treatments for ED, oral medicines, injections, procedures that might need to be done. And a urologist can take you along that entire journey, not just help to start it.
It all makes sense. And also there's some other things. I mean, it's always good to see a doctor, but of course, you know, talking about prostate cancer, there's other things that could be discovered. So it's always good to go see an expert and such as yourself. And we greatly appreciate your time here today. Dr. Paul Chung joining us, talking all things ED. And for the people, please get over to edcure.org once again to learn more. And if Dr. Chung has your ear at the end of this segment brought to us by the folks over at Boston Scientific, he is doing a webinar coming up here soon. So I'll give you all that information at the end of our hit. But once again, edcure.org, or you could text edcure to 73771. Okay, Dr. Chung, bringing it back to one of those treatments, and this is something that's interesting and something that I learned of for the very first time a couple weeks ago, talking about the implant, the penile implant. What can you tell us about the penile implant?
So first, there's actually several types of penile implants, and the one thing that I tell you straight off is I think a lot of people have a misconception on what it is, what it does, what is it. There's a lot of mystery and also a lot of fear and excitement surrounding it. But to tell you quite frankly, the ED implant has been around for a while, since the 70s, but it is a prosthesis or implant that's put inside of your genital region to help you get an erection. It does not change your ability to feel. It does not change your ability to orgasm. It does not change your ability to urinate. It only simply helps you to get an erection that is great and strong enough for sexual intercourse and allows you to maintain it for the duration that is desired. So it is a treatment option that may not be right for everybody, but everyone has a different journey, and for many people it is a viable and successful treatment option.
Interesting. Okay. And for the people that might want to go down that road, does insurance cover the implant?
It does. And every office that you might see for your urologist, they're going to go through a communication with your insurance company to ensure that it's correct, covered. And this is just how the medical hospitals and insurance companies work. They're going to do this for any type of procedure that you may undergo. But in general, the implant is covered by Medicare, for example, and many private insurances. And your provider that you see is going to work closely with you to verify this. And if it happens to be declined, should be able to and should be willing to be able to fight to get it approved.
Dr. Chung, one thing that I'm sure is important to a lot of people out there that might go down the path of said implant is whether or not people will be able to tell that you had an implant, whether you're going through. I mean, it's just it might be funny to some, but it's the truth. When you go airport security, you know, your significant other, maybe in a beginning relationship. But along those lines, will people know if somebody gets the implant done?
Yeah, that's an excellent question that many people ask me. The implant is quite concealable. And remember, there's a few types out there. So when someone is really interested in going down this route, they can even review and see these types of models with their provider in person to really understand and have the right expectation of what they're going to undergo. But nobody has to know that you have an implant in place. When you go through a medical detector, it's not going to set it off. The implants are also safe for MRI as well. So you can really continue on with your regular course of life. From several of my patients that I have, they may have multiple partners, and those multiple partners actually don't know that they have an implant.
Technology has really come a long way these days. As a matter of fact, with that, how long have implants been around, Dr. Chung?
Sure. Implants first came out in the early 1970s. However, be confident that we're not still using the same device from the 1970s. Over the years, there have been a lot of updates to make this more refined, to make it more reliable, to decrease the risk for infection, and to really maintain that integrity of the device so that it can continue to improve the quality of life for people for years to come.
Okay. We touched on it briefly there just for a second, Dr. Chung, and I'd like to revisit that if we can. We said there are different types of implants. I'm really intrigued by this. What are the different types of implants?
Sure. And the first thing that I'll say is there's no one implant that's better than the other. There are three types of implants. The first one that I commonly discuss, the malleable implant. Malleable means bendable. So this means that you have two bendable, more or less, implants that are put within side of your genital region. And the misconception with this is that it's always sticking out, and that's completely not true. These implants can be bended. They can hang down to the side, so it's very concealable. The difference between a malleable implant is that it's actually going to give you it's going to be rigid the entire time, even though it may not be protruding. But this allows someone to be able to have spontaneous sexual activity. The other type of implants are inflatable implants, meaning that there's a pump in the scrotum. You're not squeezing the testicles. You're squeezing a pump. And by squeezing that pump, it's allowing the transfer of fluid to enter hollow cylinders inside your genitals, which will then become inflated and help to produce that erection for you. So when I speak with patients, I kind of find out what their goal is. I kind of find out what type of social environment they might be in. Are they in a stable relationship? Are they single? And those type of things help people to understand and make the right decision of what type of implant that would be best for them.
All right. And, of course, anytime you get major surgery, and I'm sure that would be considered major surgery, is the risks involved. So, Dr. Chung, what are the risks involved with the penile implant surgery?
Sure. I'd really compare penile implant surgery to kind of like a hernia repair. So many men have undergone a hernia repair in the genital region. They know that after this type of surgery, you feel some fullness in the genital region. You can have some bruising, some swelling, and that's quite similar with a penile implant as well. These procedures, depending on the scenario, they can be done with an overnight stay in the hospital, Some people like to send their patients home the same day. There's no right or wrong in regards to which way it's performed. But generally, these procedures can be as quick as often 45 minutes to even a little bit more than an hour to be able to perform.
All right, once again, joined by Dr. Paul Chung, who is the assistant professor and director of reconstructive urology at Thomas Jefferson University in the great city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Plenty to discuss here with Dr. Chung. We're always appreciative of his time. All right, Dr. Chung, and you know what? It's perfect because September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, and it all connects, and especially when we're talking about men here. So I'd love to just pick your brain a little bit on prostate cancer. And I want to open up with this. Number one, what is the prevalence of prostate cancer?
Sure. That's a really important question because prostate cancer is so important to men. There are about 1.1 million men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer each year, and that actually makes prostate cancer the second most common cancer in men.
Oh, man, that's amazing, and that's a huge number. So are some men more likely to be diagnosed with prostate cancer than others, in your opinion?
Sure. Over time, we're better understanding prostate cancer, who's at risk, is all type of prostate cancer equal, all of those type of questions. However, at this, so we'll learn more about that over time. However, at this time, we know that with increased age, the risk for prostate cancer exists. We also know that black men are at higher risk for having prostate cancer, and also really people who have a family history of prostate cancer. But we really don't want to limit that to a family history of prostate cancer alone. We know that people who even have breast cancer in their family, pancreatic cancer in their family, intestinal cancers in their family are also at higher risk for having prostate cancer. So when you see a provider and have the proper discussion about that, all of these factors should be taken into account in deciding whether screening should be or not be performed. And in general, screening typically starts around anywhere from about 55 years of age. That's where the discussion should begin. For people who have risk factors, like I mentioned, screening should start a little bit earlier. However, on average, prostate cancer is most commonly diagnosed for people around when they're 66. But really, you want to diagnose prostate cancer before people have any problems. So many people say, hey, doc, well, I feel really good. I don't have any problems. I'm running a marathon. I'm swimming. And I feel like I'm at life's best. Well, that's when you want to catch prostate cancer. You don't want to catch prostate cancer when it's too late. So I encourage everyone to have that type of discussion with their primary care physician or even better, their urologist.
Makes a lot of sense, Dr. Chung. I was just going to ask. I mean, I'm a young man. Have you seen young patients before?
Oh, for sure. You know, prostate cancer doesn't know age. Mm. So even though we know that it kind of increases over time, everyone's body is different, and some people are affected earlier rather than later. I've seen patients as early as yesterday diagnosed in their 40s and treated in their 40s. I'm not saying that everyone in the 40s needs to go get screened. I don't want to encourage that. But, yes, to answer your question, it affects people of different ages.
So something to keep in mind. And when you see Prostate Cancer Awareness Month all month long, the month of September, I mean, that's really good that we're getting the message out there, correct?
Yes, I agree with you, 100%.
Questions about the treatments of prostate cancer. If someone's unfortunate enough to get prostate cancer, how do you go about treating that?
Sure. And I think it's really important for people who are undergoing the screening process to potentially understand what's at the end of the road, potentially, if they're diagnosed with that. Of course, we never want anyone to be diagnosed with prostate cancer, but unfortunately, that's not the case. There are a variety of treatments, and each individual person makes that decision based on a variety of things. First, it depends on the extent of the disease. It also depends on kind of how someone's philosophy of how they might want to be treated. But in general, there's surgery to remove the prostate, which is performed by a urologist. There can also be radiation therapy. Radiation can be delivered in a variety of ways. It can be delivered as a beam from outside of the body. We can also even have radiation feeds, which are placed inside of the prostate to deliver that radiation within. So there are a variety of ways that prostate cancer can be treated, fortunately, and it's really important to have that proper discussion with your provider so that you have a real understanding of what options exist for you.
Now, I'm not the expert here, Dr. Chung, but one thing would tell me that if somebody was to suffer from prostate cancer, they might have an issue with ED. So I'm curious, A, is that factual? And B, if so, how is prostate cancer related to urinary incontinence and ED?
Great. So that's an excellent question. When people are thinking about treatment for prostate cancer, often our number one goal is to, you know, definitely cure the cancer. However, there are always potential side effects from any treatment. And erectile dysfunction, as well as leakage of urine, or what we call incontinence, are risk factors, whether someone undergoes surgery or radiation. So it's a real risk and a real conversation. What I'd say is that it's not actually the prostate cancer itself that causes these problems. It's the treatment for the prostate cancer that causes these problems. For example, the nerves and the blood vessels that help someone to get an erection run alongside of that prostate. Well, surgically, those areas can become injured, and radiation beam crossing through that area is going to also disrupt it and cause injury to those nerves as well as blood vessels. And that can cause that erectile dysfunction. The surgery or radiation can also affect the support that somebody has, that what we call the sphincter and the muscle of the pelvic floor, to allow someone not to leak. Well, sometimes with treatment, that area can become compromised or injured, and that can cause leakage as well. So without a doubt, erectile dysfunction and urinary incontinence are some of the most common things that occur for people after prostate cancer treatment. That's why it's really important for people to see a specialist who, like myself, who specializes in sexual as well as urinary dysfunction.
Okay. Thank you. Great breakdowns across the board. Of course, Dr. Chung. Now, speaking specifically about prostate cancer treatment, what are some of the side effects that somebody might suffer from after receiving treatment for prostate cancer?
There are a variety of the side effects that people might experience. Some of the most common side effects that somebody might experience would be erectile dysfunction, and the other would be urinary incontinence or leakage of urine with activity. Of course, you can imagine these are really bothersome people, especially as they're going through this journey of trying to become a prostate cancer survivor. So it's very important to understand what the risks of developing erectile dysfunction as well as urinary incontinence are. And it's really important to work closely with a urologist after treatment to be able to improve these areas and improve that overall quality of life for patients.
And once again, for more information on prostate cancer and erectile dysfunction, please visit edcure.org. It's a very user-friendly website. Do yourself a favor. You're able to find a specialist no matter where you're at in this country. All you got to do is plug in your zip code, and it will pop up, such as great doctors as Dr. Chung, who we're joined with by right now. All right, Dr. Chung, something that we just briefly hit on, the urinary incontinence. That's something that might be new to a lot of people out there. What are the types of urinary incontinence?
You're exactly correct. There's not just one type of urinary incontinence. In general, we kind of group them into three categories, especially for people who've had some type of prostate cancer treatment. They include stress incontinence, meaning that with activity, laughing, coughing, sneezing, even walking or standing, these patients are noticing that they have some type of leakage with activity. But when they're sitting down, for example, they're not leaking. Another type of leakage is what we call urge incontinence. That means that they have the leakage that occurs when they have a strong urge. So they're trying to make it to the bathroom in time, but their need to go to the bathroom is so strong that they can't hold it, and then they leak. And there's a combination of the two, which is called mixed incontinence, where sometimes stress incontinence, a little bit of dribble of that urine that enters the urinary tube, can cause that urge, and then therefore they leak into their pants as well.
And stress is something that we all deal with. No idea if more men than women, but I know as a man myself, I deal with a ton of stress. And I learned a lot about stress in the previous years that I did not know and how much it can have an effect on your body. So stress, urinary incontinence is something that men deal with a lot.
I would say yes. Stress, urinary incontinence can happen from a variety of reasons. The most common, as we're kind of talking about today, as a side effect of prostate cancer treatment, whether it be surgery or radiation. Stress urinary incontinence can also happen even when a urologist is treating a patient for a large prostate, for example, that may not be a cancerous prostate. So there's many reasons why men may develop incontinence, and many of these people may not know that there are treatment options available. You can imagine that incontinence can be quite troublesome. There are some people who have a little bit of incontinence, or maybe they wear one pad a day. I have some patients in mind, they literally wear three very kind of thick pads to collect their urine, and they're also wearing several pull-ups throughout the day. I have some patients who are afraid to go to their friend's house and sit on their friend or neighbor's couch. They don't want to leave their home. So you can see how much of an impact stress incontinence or any type of incontinence can have on a man and on an impact on their quality of life.
Very true. Absolutely. I can imagine that would be troublesome, and you're bringing the information and greatly appreciate all the insight this morning. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the male sling. What is the male sling, Dr. Chung?
Sure. So there are treatments for incontinence, as we just spoke earlier. The male sling is very similar to what women may also undergo for leakage of urine that they develop in their own right for different type of procedures or childbirth or whatnot. But in general, a sling, whether it be a male or a female sling, is a kind of a mesh material which is placed underneath the urinary tube, and it's anchored and lifted to help support the urinary tube so that there's a little bit of a backdrop so that the urine isn't able to just escape out through the penis. There's a little bit of a backdrop or a wall so that the urine is kind of stopped before it actually leaks through.
And Boston Scientific, I'm pretty sure that they have a male sling that they offer as well.
You're correct. They do have a sling. The name for it is called an Advanced XP sling. And as we kind of just discussed, it helps to kind of keep the urethra closed so that there's a little bit of resistance there, so that if someone were to cough, sneeze, or lift something heavy, that it'd be a little bit of support so that the urine isn't able to just escape and come right out.
All right, Dr. Chung, one more question. Are there treatments for urinary incontinence?
Yeah, Sean, there actually are. And, you know, there's a lot of men out there who don't know that these treatment options exist. These options help to kind of recreate that support for the urinary tube called the urethra so that the urine can't just dribble out. These treatment options called a sling or an artificial urinary sphincter, they actually work in a different manner, and then they kind of are targeted toward a different group. For example, the sling might be best for somebody who might have a kind of minimal leakage, 1 to 2 pads of leakage per day, versus a sphincter, which is anything greater than that. But these are great options. They help to support the urethra to provide resistance so that when a man laughs, coughs, and sneezes, that urine isn't able to escape right away and that there's a little bit of a backdrop or resistance to prevent that leakage. These are truly procedures that can help improve quality of life. You can imagine that leaking, wearing diapers, wearing pads is definitely not good quality of life and not enjoyable, and can really affect people's mood as well as confidence.
Okay, Dr. Chung, as I said many times, greatly appreciate your expert opinion on all things ED, but we did have somebody call in and they were listening and they were wondering if we can go back to the implant conversation just for a second. And they asked a specific question and they were wondering, what is the partner satisfaction rate for the implant?
Oh, that's an excellent question. And it's not just partner satisfaction, but it's also the person who's receiving it. How satisfied are they? And there's been a lot of studies evaluating both patients as well as the partner, and satisfaction rates are extremely high, greater than 90 and 95% for both the partner as well as the patient. And they've looked at how easy is it to use, does it feel realistic, are you able to have the sexual encounter that you would like to do, how is the strength of the erection. All of those factors have been studied.
Awesome. Well, that's excellent information, Dr. Chung, and we greatly appreciate a couple minutes of your time to give us all things information that we need right now on ED. And for somebody that might be joining us late or tuning in the middle or wants to know a little bit more information, well, first of all, I'm going to give them the website, and Dr. Chung is also hosting a webinar coming up here on October 7th. So first of all, the website is edcure.org, and that's all your ED questions are answered. Great user-friendly website, understanding ED, symptoms and causes, heart disease, prostate cancer, a ton of information there. And plus, it's real easy to find a specialist. All you have to do is plug your zip code into the website, and you might land Dr. Chung if you're in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Let's just say that. Also, for the people out there that want information, more information from Dr. Chung, you're hosting a webinar, Dr. Chung, and that is on October 7th. And for the people that want more information or to register, you can go ahead and text EDINFO to 72345. Break out a pen, write this down. EDINFO to 72345. What type of information will they be learning on that webinar, Dr. Chung?
Sure. This is a great opportunity for people to come together and hear a talk by me about erectile dysfunction and men's health issues, similar to what we've discussed today, but in a lot more depth. As we discussed at the very onset of this, men, we just don't talk about it enough. We don't learn about what's going on in our bodies enough. We don't know what options exist. And there are plenty of options out there for ED. And that's really going to be the focus of the webinar that we're doing. And the great thing about the webinar is, you know, a lot of people might be shy of coming into a clinic or joining a group, in-person group to kind of discuss these issues. But at the webinar, you're going to hear a great presentation, and you're going to have opportunity to ask any type of questions that you might have from the comfort of your own home. And you're able to ask your any question that you might have, and we can do our best to answer them for you.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to that webinar on October 7th. And as I said, Dr. Chung, we greatly appreciate your information and insight this morning, and we look forward to catching up down the road. Thank you very much for this segment, all brought to us by the fine folks over at Boston Scientific. Thank you very much, Dr. Chung.
Thank you for having me, Sean, and I hope that people are able to take a few pointers away on men's health and ED and prostate cancer. It's really important that we stay on top of it.